And the theme is connection. So generally, there's an overall theme for Buddhist Action Month. So that's quite a wide a brief, really. We could almost do whatever we liked. And our guiding image is Indra's net, which we'll say a bit more about in the talk I'm just going to give. So we've got the shrine, which I'm very grateful for Alison, to Alison for doing. And we've also got an Indra's net installation in the front room. And I expect Sarah will say a little bit more about that later. So the idea of the Sangha nights basically is to try to link in our Dharma practice with the theme of Buddhist action. And then there'll be a lot of other events during the month of a different, more sort of action-y type flavour, as it were. And Sarah will say a bit about that before tea break. So what I'm going to do is to kick us off with a talk really around this theme of connection. So I thought initially that I find this label, Buddhist action, a bit odd. Because surely as Buddhists we are active, you know, we're ethically active, we're developing awareness and so on. And so I found it helpful just to clarify at the start that I think what we're talking about here is just for this month, giving a bit more focus to the issue of how our Buddhist practice relates to the wider spheres of human society and the ecosystem. That's the way I think of it, at least. So what are the aspects in those spheres that really interest us, concern us, that we feel we might want to do something about? And at what level do we want to engage in those things? So this talk has actually been quite a personal journey for me as well, and quite an emotional journey, and I've woven some of that in, hopefully not totally irrelevantly. You'll see, I'm going to start off with that. So I began by reflecting that my personal history around social and political action had been a lot to do with disconnection. But there was a lot of positive energy in it too. So I was in my 20s in the late 1970s, and I was carried along by a stream of idealistic political movements. So when the Triratna movement was in its first decade, I was in study groups reading Lenin and Marx and the Communist Manifesto. So I felt happy on picket lines, you know, trotting out to the South African embassy to be arrested. And I felt satisfied because I was doing something meaningful. I wanted a new world based on love, and not on profit. Albania and China were my pure lands. And I was a believer in the revolution, a true believer. So when the capitalist economy collapsed, as it inevitably would, greed would fall away, and new relations between people would spring up and become possible based on cooperation and peace. Then finding my comrades maybe, well, you know, not so aware of personal issues, let's say. Later on I joined the women's movement and movements around sexual identity. So I lived communally, we shared our incomes, we shared our lives, many other things, and our ideas. And that was a time of passion, love, idealism. And there was also dogmatism and intolerance. So the Maoist party I supported hated capitalism, of course, but we also hated anyone who disagreed with us, especially those in other, you know, bourgeois left parties with subtly different initials. So we thrust the worker at passers-by on the street corners. And in my feminist circles, feeling we needed to make a point about pornography, we armed ourselves with lots of tubes of superglue, and under cover of nightfall, we glued up the locks of W.H. Smith and other news agents with dubious publications on their shelves. So this is an example. And I was thinking, as a way of bringing people around to our point of view, it wasn't exactly subtle. And not effective. So times changed and the pure lands turned out not to be so pure. I learned to meditate and gradually my life reoriented around the Dharma. So I began to face more inward than outward. I became more self-aware And I understood that I needed to transform not just society, but myself. And that gave me pause to think. It seemed clear that the world, too, needed something deeper than reorganisation at the material level. Buddhist practice addressed that depth for me. It showed a way of really putting an end to suffering by uprooting greed, hatred and ignorance in individual consciousnesses. But then the whole issue became tricky. I began to question the whole point of doing anything at the level of the material world or at the level of social organisation. Didn't the Buddha say that development of mind is what counts? And couldn't I see that that was true? Yes. Surely the best use of my time would be to deepen my own meditation, practice ethics at an individual level, and do my best to communicate the Dharma. But this didn't feel entirely comfortable, and I began to experience another kind of disconnect, a divide between the spiritual and the material, the individual and the collective. So why Buddhist action? What is the connection between these spheres? Maybe surprisingly, there's one traditional answer, and I find this quite reassuring. It's mentioned in a lecture by Sangharakshita on Padmasambhava. It is that humanity needs a manam. So the setting for this is a vast cosmological perspective of ancient India, which sees worlds come and go in endless evolutions. And whenever human beings re-emerge in these evolutions, there also appears an archetypal lawgiver. And this Manu's function is to lay down the basis for society according to positive and helpful principles of organisation. He comes before the Buddha because humanity needs him first. If people don't have a social context which reflects positive values, they won't hear the Buddha's message. So the Manu prepares the way for the Buddha. We can consider, too, the Buddha's teachings to the political leaders of his time, and we'll be hearing a bit more about that in week 4 of BAM, when Vajratara comes to give a talk. And there's a story from the Pali Canon, taken from the commentary to the Dhammapada. And the tale here is that the Buddha is just about to deliver a Dharma talk when he sees a man in the crowd who hasn't eaten all day. So the Buddha stops mid-track and insists that the man be fed before he continues the talk. And not everybody in the assembly understands this. Why stop the Dharma? But the Buddha's response is that nobody suffering from hunger can comprehend the Dharma he taught. Hunger is the greatest of all afflictions, he said to have said. So from these teachings, I take two things. Firstly, that there's the gritty truth that material welfare is of huge importance. When there is hunger, what do we do first? Offer food or preach? When the person is homeless and desperate, what do we do first? Help them get off the street or teach them to meditate? But secondly, we're profoundly affected by the values of the culture and society in which we live. And for us, of course, there's much to be grateful for in living in an affluent society where there's a lot of freedom and so on. But I just wonder how aware we are, or can be, as to how deeply individual consciousnesses are influenced by the prevailing norms and ideas that come with decades and centuries of development of a society in which profit has driven and which is profoundly materialistic, profoundly scientific, profoundly rationalistic. So I find this a bit easier to imagine, this idea of the influence on our consciousnesses of these things. If I dream the opposite, what would be the effect on consciousness if, for many decades, our government had charted progress not in terms of GNP, but national happiness? If, when a serious crime was committed, we would expect to hear the Prime Minister express compassion for the perpetrator, as well as the victims. What if, as the poet Adrian Henry said, tonight at noon, supermarkets will advertise 3 pence extra on everything. Elephants will tell each other human jokes. America will declare peace on Russia. So a radically different society would bring radically different conditions to the formation of our mental states. And to those who say, ah, yes, but the individual must change first, Sangharakshita has quite a good answer. He says, the view that we must change the system is generally regarded as the secular view, and the view that it is up to the individual to change is generally regarded as the spiritual view. In fact, these views are not mutually exclusive. Spiritual movements are generally expected to adopt the spiritual view, but if this is so, the FWBO, now Sri Ratna, is an exception. Yes, the development of the individual is fundamental in transforming the world, but at the same time, it is important to recognize that external conditions can help or hinder us in our development. And elsewhere he says, one has to make or try to make some effort to transform the society in which one lives. It's all very well to talk about the lotus blooming in the midst of the mire, but it is very difficult to be a lotus when the mire is particularly nasty or particularly all-pervasive. So we could say that this project to transform society as well as ourselves is part of the DNA, I think, of the True Ratna movement. You know, right from the start of Sangharakshita's own involvement with the Dalits in India, to the early days of the movement when people worked and lived together as part of spiritual practice, creating what Sangharakshita called a blueprint for a new world. The world I have in mind, he said, is an entirely new world, a world radically different from the old one. And to see into this relationship between society and the individual more deeply is one way of seeing the truth that the Buddha saw, the truth that nothing exists independently as a separate entity. There is simply dependent arising. So a way of imagining this is as a vast network of connections, and we have Indra's net, which is a classic image of interconnectedness. So it's conjured like this. Far away, in the heavenly abode of the great god Indra, there is a wonderful net which has been hung by some cunning artificer in such a manner that it stretches out infinitely in all directions. In accordance with the extravagant tastes of deities, the artificer has hung a single glittering jewel in each eye of the net. And since the net itself is infinite in dimension, the jewels are infinite in number. There hang the jewels, glittering like stars in the first magnitude, a wonderful sight to behold. If we now arbitrarily select one of these jewels for inspection, and look closely at it, we will discover that in its polished surface there are reflected all the other jewels in the net, infinite in number. Not only that, but each of the jewels reflected in this one jewel is also reflected in all the other jewels, so that there is an infinite reflecting process occurring. So Indra's net invites us to see that all life exists as a multiplicity of conditions that interrelate, reflect one another. And if we can, we need to see the net as a dynamic structure as well. The reflections are not static. They move and change all the time, producing infinite numbers of combinations influencing each other, coming together and moving into yet new combinations constantly. So all life exists in this way, nothing fixed, nothing that has its own independent essence, separate from the whole. And if we take one jewel, anything we think of in the world that we see, including ourselves, and we look closely at it, we glimpse the fact that it depends for its existence on innumerable conditions. In fact, if we look really closely, we will see that actually there are no jewels in Indra's net. What we thought were fixed, separate jewels are in fact just the right play of reflections. The same is true in this world. If we look, feel, or sense really closely, we find that what we've labelled as separate, independent things are fluid, contingent. Life escapes the boxes that we try to put it into. So bringing this net of mutual influence, as it were, down to earth, I think with even a glimpse of the complexity of Indra's net, we can appreciate how ourselves are influenced by social and cultural norms, how we influence our own environment, are influenced by others, and so on. So nothing we do is without effect, near or remote. And when we start to take this in, we might wake up to sort of a sense of kinship with life, and the suffering of others comes closer to home. So we're connected to the animals we farm, that we eat and profit from. We're connected to the adults and children working in sweatshops far away producing the clothes that we wear. And in this way, feeling the suffering of others as one's own is very much part of the flavour of engaged Buddhism throughout the world. And Thich Nhat Hanh and his brothers in monastic orders in Vietnam during the war said that they felt the pain of the Vietnamese people as their own, and it was impossible to stay secluded. Should we continue to practice in our monasteries, or would we have to leave meditation halls in order to help the people suffering under the bombs? After careful reflection, we decided to do both, to go out and help the people and to do so in mindfulness. We called it engaged Buddhism. Mindfulness must be engaged. Once there is seeing, there must be acting. So, once there is seeing, there must be acting. But in our everyday lives here, I expect that it's often not so straightforward that we just see what needs to be done, we see what ethical choice we want to make, and we do it. Even if we think we do see, something complicates our choices and we're held back. So I'd like to just touch briefly on two aspects here: feeling overwhelmed and getting stuck in ill will. And I think we experience, or might experience, both of those things because of the root problem identified by the Buddha, which is that we're clouded by ignorance. We don't see things as they really are. We generally don't fully see Indra's net. We resist the flow of life, its impermanence. And we tend to see things, including ourselves, as independent, separate entities. We imagine a separate me, as if we could somehow sever the links in the net and stand alone as an individual jewel unaffected by all the rest. And then we imagine ourselves as a jewel in the centre of this net, this world, from which we've severed ourselves. And our project becomes self-defence, trying to grasp, keep only what we want, only what's not threatening, what makes us feel secure, and push away what threatens us. So in this way, we hope we can control. And there are many reasons why we do that and how we do it. But as the Buddha taught, this strategy always fails and leads to suffering. But that suffering also is not inevitable. Eventually, through practice, with sensitivity, and in whatever way works for us, we learn to let go more into our connectedness with life. So I want you to say something about feeling overwhelmed, because I think it's quite a common thing. So we might think of taking some kind of action, making some ethical choice, or maybe getting involved in something, and we feel, well, what good would any of it do? The troubles of the world are so huge that what I can do alone is pointless. And we can justify actions or non-actions in this way. You know, what difference does it really make if I, as just one person, avoid products tested on animals, consume less, move my bank account because I'm concerned that there's investment in the arms trade? Well, maybe we don't even get that far. Maybe there's just a vague feeling of powerlessness and fear when we think of the state of the world, and our tendency is to withdraw. It's a painful state to be in, and it's a real double bind, because then we don't do what we actually can do, and this only strengthens our sense of powerlessness. So I think what often goes hidden in this is that there can be at the same time a sense of over-responsibility. Behind the feeling of powerlessness is the feeling that we should be able to solve the problems of the world. You know, we can't stop wars or climate change, and so we are bad and a failure. We want to be in control, and it's painful to understand that we're not. So, crudely put, I think we have this situation that we think we have no influence and yet are totally responsible. But it can be helpful to see that these are only views constructed out of this illusory sense of separate selfhood. We place ourselves in the centre of things, in both views, that we are powerless and yet responsible. We've imagined ourselves as the jewel in the centre, but as disconnected from the net. As centre jewel, of course, everything is supposed to depend on us. But in this view, we do stand disconnected, so of course, we fail to see how we can influence anything. The reality is that in any situation, multiple conditions are at play, changing all the time. So all conditions matter. Anything we do matters and has an effect. And I was reminded of a simple thing that the present Dalai Lama said, which is that he never passes a light that's on without switching it off. Simple thing. But if he sees a light, he switches it off and he never thinks to himself, it's only a light, it doesn't matter. I was reminded also of a verse from the Dhammapada. A water pot becomes full by falling drops of water. The wise person, little by little, fills up with good. Every drop counts, every drop of good action. But no condition trumps it all. It doesn't depend all on us, and therefore we can't control. So being an I am responsible type of person myself, I have to remind myself of this a lot. I could worry about whether this talk is okay, for example. But actually, I know that the effect of it depends only partly, maybe even not very much, on me. And much depends on numerous conditions in this room, including conditions in all of you. I could feel that I'm practicing, in a sense, on my own. I have to engage, have to gain sort of enlightenment for all sentient beings on my own. But collective practice isn't like that. It shows me it's not so. So when we meditate or do puja together, or in deepening spiritual friendships, I know that there's a lot going on in this coming together of conditions, of positive energies, and these mutual influences are what counts. So something in me then moves from the sense of I to a sense of we, and sometimes out further than that, to a connection beyond the we. So if we can relax more into the reality that we exist within a web of conditions, that we're not central, we may be able to value our contribution to the world more sanely. We do what we can, and we let go of wanting a result, or wanting to control a result. So Loka Bandhu, who's in our order, gives me a sense of what this could look like in a situation where we might want to join in an action or a campaign, but we wonder what good it could do. Loka Bandhu spent some time in Palestine, and on one visit he protested against the occupation of the West Bank and the building of the wall around Palestine. It was worth doing, he said, for three reasons: to offer friendship and practical support to those Palestinians who wished to protest peacefully and were being threatened by police, to open himself up to more awareness of what was happening in the world to fellow human beings, and to give a message, not in our name. In other words, to protest the lack of involvement from other governments. He certainly couldn't control events. He couldn't stop the wall being built or bring peace to the two sides. But he could add his presence to join in with energies that he felt were going in a positive direction. So the second area I want to mention is getting stuck in ill will. So this can often happen, I think, because we identify with causes and views. And I'm thinking of situations in which we sort of start out by being concerned about something. We identify with a view about what causes our concern, and without noticing it, we allow our perspective to get narrowed. It becomes one of those things that we cling to preserve that idea of our separate self we feel we need. So we become that view. I am the person who thinks this. And then, it's now us and them. We are on the side of the angels, and those other views, those people who oppose us, are bad. And we shore up ourselves by talking about how bad they are, maybe. So not seeing Indra's net, we don't want to see the whole situation. We don't even want to imagine how many conditions there must be in shaping that other person, that enemy, or the people who oppose us. Our opponents are our enemy. We have nothing to do with them. We don't see the basic humanity that links us. We don't want to see that they too live, suffer, and die. But also their dual-like configurations in Indra's net. That their greed, hatred, and delusion are also in us, and we reflect them back. So as Buddhists, we might be aware of the dangers of this, and we might think of the famous words of the Dhammapada, hatred is never appeased by hatred. And we might see the world of politics and social action as too tainted with dogmatism. We don't want to get enmeshed. Or maybe we get enmeshed anyway. But there is a different possibility. And that seeing, or doing our best to see Indra's net, we can get involved, form opinions, but hold a bigger perspective. So we put ourselves in the shoes of our opponents and imagine all the things that have made them what they are. We are aware that they have ignorance, and their ignorance will cause them suffering. And we are aware of our own ignorance too, which at bottom is the same as theirs, the same nature as theirs. So if we stretch ourselves further, we may start even to imagine them as a whole person, God forbid, and see the good in them. That's a bit risky, isn't it? So there's a lovely poem by William Stafford that expresses this. It's called For the Unknown Enemy. This monument is for the unknown good in our enemies. Like a picture, their life began to appear. They gathered at home in the evening and sang. Above their fields, they saw a new sky. A holiday came and they carried the baby to the park for a party. Sunlight surrounded them. Here we glimpse what our minds long turned away from. The great mutual blindness darkened that sunlight in the park, and the sky that was new and the holidays. This monument says that one afternoon we stood here, letting a part of our minds escape. They came back, but different. Enemy, one day we glimpsed your life. This monument is for you. So it can be inspiring too to think of leading Buddhists such as the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh and many others in war-torn countries especially, who've seen and experienced so much suffering, and yet they just seem to embody love and they're empty of the need to take revenge. But I think we don't have to be in such extreme situations to see that it's important to recognise and work with ill will. And we can start close to home. You know, there's those speeches on the telly from politicians that just get our goat, rile us up. Can we see them as whole people? People in the Sangha, maybe, who just don't see the way the things the way we do. How extraordinary is that? You know, we're all Buddhists. So I could start with my family, who voted the wrong way in the EU referendum. But doing our best to hold this bigger perspective doesn't mean, I think, being afraid to take any stance at all, or even have strong opinions and express them. And it doesn't mean sort of staking one's identity on being a nice, peaceful Buddhist. So, you know, we're the calm people, we stay out of the fray. We are not like those others who are opinionated and angry. Christopher Titmus said, made a very sort of wry comment, the first step on the Noble Eightfold Path is right view, not timid view, not comforting view, and not non-view. So do let's speak to challenge racism and other prejudice. Take part if we're moved to in campaigns to end injustice, stop abuses. Let's march against animal experiments, carrying animal coffins through the streets, as did the Amida Trust in Cambridge, or sit in meditation at an arms fair, bearing placards saying, I am a Buddhist and I am opposed to the arms trade. So these actions confront the harm done in the world. Let's not be afraid of our emotions and passion to create a better world. But let's not lose our sense of connection with humanity as well. Let's see as far as we can into Indra's net. And to be on this path and to be prepared to gaze deeper into Indra's net, we need all the love and stability of equanimity that we can muster. I want to round up with a few words on this. So equanimity has been described as an unshakable balance of mind rooted in insight. It's an island to give us a firm footing in the middle of a restless ocean. It's the culmination of the other three Brahma Viharas, or heavenly abodes, of metta, compassion, sympathetic joy. It contains all those, and it sees the whole perspective, the ups and downs, all the suffering and joy. It steadies us when blown about by the worldly winds, pleasure, pain, loss and gain, status, disgrace, praise and criticism. So equanimity just welcomes everything that arises, and its enemies are prejudice and indifference. The steadiness of equanimity is not aloof, but deeply engaged. Pema Chodron says that it is not at all the same as an ultimate harmony where everything is finally smooth. It is more a matter of being fully engaged with whatever comes to our door. We could call it being completely alive. So I pick this out because I feel that developing equanimity is something really practical and helpful we can do to support our engagement with the world. One reason is that it balances pain with pleasure, suffering with joy. If life is hard, even tragic, there's always more to it than just suffering. So we can think that we need to sort of grind our loins. That's a bit of a strange concept, isn't it? Good, our loins to grind. Well, you never know. We're actually suffering and difficulties. We're trying to do something about it. It's that kind of thing I'm trying to get over in that very odd mixed metaphor. But on one level, that's just a view, isn't it? You know, we need to be prepared to meet joy as well. And laughter. So this is Han from Being Peace. He says, to suffer is not enough. Life is filled with suffering, but it is also filled with many wonders, like the blue sky, the sunshine, the eyes of a baby. To suffer is not enough. Each day, 40,000 children die of hunger, yet the sunrise is beautiful, and the rose that bloomed this morning along the wall is a miracle. Life is both dreadful and wonderful. So if engaged Buddhism means feeling suffering more as one's own, we can also feel joy more as our own. Equanimity sees Indra's net. It sees with the eyes of wisdom. So when we feel powerless in the face of the troubles of the world, it reminds us that everything we do does matter. All conditions matter. We can influence. When we might fall into despair or frustration because we can't change things, it reminds us that there are always myriad conditions in play. Nothing depends just on us. We are not in control. And if there are good results, if there's a resounding victory for the forces of good on Thursday, for example, mentioning no names, equanimity gently pulls us back from the intoxication and euphoria which we might otherwise feel. Yeah, in our dreams, eh? Equanimity sees that all of life wants to be happy, and yet that human beings cause their own suffering through their failure to understand the connectedness of life, their illusion of separation. So when we do harden into fixed positions, go into opposition mode, it softens us by showing that our enemies are basically the same as us, conditioned beings with the same difficulties, the same human potential. Basically, it calls us to identify with the world rather than separate us, ourselves off from it. So just to end, throughout writing this talk, I was thinking again of my own personal history and asking myself, how do I stand with all that now? And what became of that passionate, idealistic, and sometimes angry young woman who believed that the world would change for the good? Where's that energy now? These questions are still very live for me, so what you're getting now in these sort of final paragraphs of just what's current. And firstly, while writing this talk, I was struck by the fact that there was a sense of despair in me, and gradually it became clear that the new world I'd envisaged was not dawning. I lost my naivety, that's a good thing, but somewhere along the line I also lost hope. For a long time I deepened my Buddhist practice and married that with what I felt I could offer, as it were, in a sort of more worldly sense. So I took my practice into my work, in the community as a lawyer, and in other areas such as prison chaplaincy. And this seemed enough, or at any rate it was the best I could do. But inside I think I was still grieving for the passing of that hopeful innocence, that idealism. And I'm still passionate. I still want to change the world. And I understand that at the deepest level, the only level that ultimately counts, change means change in the individual and collective consciousnesses. So it means the uprooting of the causes, the uprooting of greed, hatred and delusion taught by the Buddha. However, while writing this talk, I became aware with some surprise that I also believe this. In the world today, when the mire is particularly nasty, Sangharakshita put it, it's not enough only to teach the Dharma. That's my view anyway. Although the Buddha's Dharma is what counts at the ultimate level, change at the level of social and political organisation is needed to prepare the way. We also need a Manu, the archetypal lawgiver. And quite honestly, I can't see a Manu at present on the horizon. So coming to that realisation, I wondered, why am I not in despair about this? And actually, despite all of this, there's something in me that now trusts deeply, that does have hope, that is at ease with the world. Why is this? It's hard to explain this without in a sort of narrative way, so the only thing I could think of doing was to tell you about the giant armadillo. The giant armadillo lives in South America. Apparently it has about 80 to 100 teeth. 800 teeth would be quite something, but that's still more, I think, than any mammal. And it has enormous claws to sort of paw away anthills and things. It's solitary, nocturnal, and slow-moving, which is its downfall, unfortunately. And it keeps its young for 1 year in a very large burrow. And this is important, because when it leaves the burrow turns into what a recent documentary called Hotel Armadillo. The burrow provides shelter for some 80 species. They come and go, snakes, lizards, ocelots, all kinds of things. And some make their home there, some feed off others using the burrow. The burrow is like a glorious Indra's net of supporting conditions, supporting connections. But the giant armadillo is endangered. If it goes, the burrow goes, and so the whole ecosystem is also affected. And there are sadly few of these creatures left now. So a reporter asked a conservation worker, doesn't he despair, seeing the armadillo still hunted, seeing its habitat disappearing? But the man just hugely smiled, this enormous smile, and he said, yes, of course he knew all that, and he was doing the best he could. But, he said, the real joy is that I just love these animals. And I take pictures of them, and I show them in the schools where children have never seen armadillos, and I show them what they are, and then the children start to love them too. And I can't think of any better way to spend my life. So in some way I can't maybe properly articulate, this communicates how I feel. Experiencing life more deeply, loving it more deeply, seeing its wonderful, reflecting, jewel-like nature, even the suffering in all of that, in the end is what matters. And there's a quote from St. Gratia along these lines which says, "Not for our own sake, not even for the sake of others, should we seek to attain the divine, but simply for its own irresistible sake." So life, in a way, life for me has its own answer, is its own answer, which isn't at all to deny the need for action. But I suppose what I feel is just the more deeply that we can connect, the more wholeheartedly and joyfully we can act. So maybe that's why the title to this talk, which came to me before I even knew what would be in it, is just called Only Connect. So that's it.